This is the Catholic Movie Guy Podcast.
Whoa. What a difference a week makes, eh? It's the Catholic Movie Guy Podcast. As the fine lady told you at the beginning, I'm Steve Wickmer. I'm the Catholic Movie Guy. I'm pretty much, you know, I'm certainly in the top five of Catholic movie persons, I would say. Maybe I'm the Catholic Movie Guy. I don't know. But in any event, a week ago, you know, Hillary Clinton was going to be president, and now it's Donald Trump, which was pretty shocking. I took no small amount of pleasure in the meltdown of everyone. But that's not what we're here to talk about. You know, this isn't a political show. I don't care if you voted for Hillary, and I don't care if you voted for Trump. I don't really care if you voted. I don't really care about you. What I care about is the movies. That's what I care about. The movies. And that's what we talk about on this podcast. If you like the podcast, please listen to all the episodes. But if you're not going to listen to it, I beg you, just download them, you know, subscribe to them, go on iTunes and review them, 5 stars only. Do whatever you got to do, you know, to promote me, because it's important, you know. I'm changing the world one earbud at a time, possibly two at a time. But please, if you like the podcast, do those things. It really, really, really helps out. Today, we're going to talk about a movie that I don't know if it's going to get a lot of play, because it's not the most popular movie. But you should take that as an open-minded person to occasion you to listen to this podcast after watching the movie, because this podcast is going to spoil the heck out of the movie. There's really not... I mean, it's not the type of movie that, like, blows your mind spoiler-wise. It's not like The Usual Suspects or The Sixth Sense or something like that. I don't want to scare you away. But we can't talk about the movie without talking about the entirety of the movie in minute detail. So if you are a purist like me and you want to watch it fresh, by all means, go ahead. Content-wise, for the discerning viewer, there's really only language to deal with. But, you know, if you want to go watch it by all means, then please come back. Download first, watch it, come back, and listen to the podcast where we discuss things at length. In a few minutes, I'm going to bring on the Tin Man, our favorite guest, and thus far our only guest. I will have it known that I asked the Brewmaster General, hey, come on the podcast. He said, I disavow, because he didn't really feel like doing it. Perhaps in the future, he will be on the podcast. We have many exciting guests coming up, many, many bigly guests coming up. But today we're just going to stick with Tim. Tim's been through a rough week. We'll talk about that. But what we're going to talk about most is the movie, which is Inside Llewyn Davis, a 2013 Coen Brothers film that I have watched twice in its entirety now. And I still am processing it, because, like, you know, all the Coen Brothers films, it takes a little bit to let it sit after the meal to decide how you felt about it. This one is a subject matter which might not appeal to everybody, but which is very appealing to me because I consider myself a big music fan. In fact, I like, you know, music almost more than the movies, but no podcast about that yet. And this movie's about, you know, it's not based on a true story. It's not even pretending to be based on a true story, but it's loosely based on an historical era, which is the folk scene in the early 60s in Greenwich Village in New York. And it follows one particular folk singer, Llewyn Davis, and his journey in trying to stay true to what he believes and also to make it, whatever that means, in the industry. He, in the movie, recently suffered through a tragic event, which is that his folk singing partner committed suicide. And he's kind of left in the lurch trying to find his own voice, while also becoming successful, whatever that means. So the movie, plot-wise, isn't exactly, you know, in-depth. It's just following him through his life, his travails, and how he deals with them while trying to still, you know, be a successful folk artist, but still be a true folk artist. The movie also follows him as he goes through some personal difficulties. He has an affair with one of his friend and musical colleague's wife, and actually she finds out that she's pregnant. She's not sure if it's Llewyn's or her, I don't know if it's her husband or her boyfriend, but her partner's. And Llewyn offers to pay for her abortion. We learn through the movie that this is not the first time that he's done this. He also did this with a prior relationship, And he does it with a very cavalier attitude. And I can see how that would turn viewers off, and it's meant to turn viewers off. I don't think it's portrayed positively at all, contrary to some reviewers. And it really shows you the selfishness that's involved in making that decision. And the way it turns out in the film, which we'll get to in an in-depth way, discussing it with the Tin Man, shows that it's not so it's not such a simple decision after all. And so Lewin's torn throughout the movie between, you know, the personal responsibility of this information, becoming a father, which he seemingly dismisses, but which I think it's clear from the movie he is affected by more than he lets on, and how that should guide his decision-making, with the expectations of his family, which wants him to, you know, settle down and get a real job, get a real life, so to speak, and with his own desire to make it in the folk industry while also making it as a folk singer and not selling out. There's a great scene with him, you know, what he has to do to get by and the level that he has to stoop to with Justin Timberlake in another role singing a song that is hilarious about Kennedy and the space program. Go ahead and watch it. I won't ruin it for you. But anyway, so we follow Lewin throughout his day. We get inside Lewin Davis. What makes him tick? What's he about? And what is this movie trying to tell us? I thought it was a fantastic movie. I'm still processing it, and I'm going to process it further with the Tin Man in just a moment. But first, I'd like to get, just if I could, a brief take from an outsider. You know, someone who's not a Catholic movie guy. And that outsider is my wife. Hey, honey, it's me.
Hey, how are you?
I'm okay. You know that movie Inside Lewin Davis?
Yes.
Did you like that?
I did, yes.
And we're back! With a bourbon near my hand. But nice. Not in it. In the Tin Man. Also not in my hand. It's a Catholic podcast, Tim.
Oh, I mean, of course not.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Tin Man has gotten this podcast out. He has recently been waylaid. Would you say you were waylaid?
Yeah.
Would you say you were tooken out?
No, I would say I was real gallbladdery, and now I am gallbladderless.
You have no gall.
Well, there may be gall, but I have no bladder to contain it.
I'm galled.
Possibly.
Certainly I'm gruntled.
I was feeling real bad. Now I feel wonderful. Just wonderful.
Awkward silence. That was Jiminy Glick. No Jack Buck impersonations today?
I had a problem with my gut. It affected... Well, we'll leave it there.
Fill in the limerick yourself. But anyway, we're here today to discuss not your gall or any other area of your... frame, but Inside Lewin Davis, the great, great Coen Brothers film.
Presumably, he has a gallbladder.
Disappointed sigh. Are you merry? Are you happy?
Yeah,
you good? You're jolly?
I feel groovy.
All right. Oh, groovy. Oh, that's one of my pet peeves. Anyway, all right, so let's proceed. So you've seen this movie how many times?
I've seen this movie one times, and certain parts of it other times.
And overall impressions.
It's fantastic. It is a Coen Brothers movie to start with. And I just thought it was really, really a great story. It captured you all the way through, and which is really impressive considering if you took it superficially, it might be considered relentlessly depressing.
Well, and really, nothing happens. Okay, so this discussion is going to be spoiler-laden. So please, if like I said at the beginning, if you're going to... at all not want a spoiler, go ahead and watch the movie now. It's streaming on Amazon. I don't know if it's on Netflix, but it's definitely on Amazon. But really, plot wise like trying to summarize the plot of the movie, is it's very uneventful.
You don't really know how long it takes. I guess it's within a week or a fortnight.
It's just a couple day period.
Just a couple days, because yeah, he makes it to Chicago and all the way back.
Right, I mean, but at one point he's talking with his sister, and he says, or no, he was talking with Jan. What's her name? Jean or Jan?
Jean.
Jean. Talking with Jean, and he's asking about whether she's had the abortion or not, which we'll get to in a minute. And she says, no, it's not till Saturday. He says, oh, it feels like forever, but it's only been a couple days' time. And that's actually a good jumping off point, because I think that's kind of the point of the movie, which is that a couple days in this guy's life, it doesn't really matter whether it was 2 weeks that went by or 2 days. He's stuck in the same cycle over and over again.
Right. And he's making choices that seem to never end, and he never is able to escape himself. Thus, he is inside Lewa Davis. Yeah,
so the movie's title comes from, well, I mean, it has several meanings. I like to play the name game, as one of my other favorite podcasts talks about. Why'd they name this movie this particular name? This one is easy. It's about Lewa Davis, but it's also about the fact that his album, which he just released, which is the jumping point off of the movie, is called Inside Lewa Davis.
And in fact, the only time you ever see that title, it's not in the title. It's not in the credits. It's on the album cover when he shows it to the F. Murray Abraham character, is the only time you see Inside Lewa Davis appear on screen.
Right. And then, of course, beyond that, we're trying to get to know exactly what's going on inside of Lewa Davis, and it's not altogether clear. One of the interesting theories about... Well, I guess one of the interesting points of the movie is that Lewin had a partner named Mike who... I guess they had some modicum of success, although they weren't really successful. More successful than he is solo.
He appeared to be an Art Garfunkel-ish figure. And they had one album that they put out that included, though they called it a different title, Dink's Song by the great Bob Dylan.
He didn't write the song. But yeah.
No, but whenever Bob performs a song, it's his song. He perfects it.
I do enjoy just looking at the album covers. These are so appropriate. None of them are real, but they all look like they could have come straight out of 1961.
Yeah.
They're so great. Especially like the Al Cody album cover.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites. But back to the duo. So his partner commits suicide, and obviously that's troubling Lewin quite a bit.
And how does he commit suicide?
By jumping off of the... Don't tell me. He doesn't jump off the Brooklyn Bridge. He jumps off the what bridge?
The George Washington Bridge.
Yeah. Traditionally, one commits suicide by jumping off the Brooklyn Bridge, as John Goodman says.
Yeah, who does that? It's fantastic.
John Goodman's little bit is great. But the other main character in the movie, besides Lou, and I would argue the second most important character, is a cat that seems to follow Lou wherever he goes, whose name we don't learn at the beginning of the movie. And basically, a lot of the hypotheses about what the movie's all about revolve around the cat being Lewin, Lewin being the cat. In fact, at one point, the cat gets away, and its owner, Mr. Gorfine, calls Lewin, and Lewin says, "Don't worry, I have the cat." And Professor Gorfine says, "You are the cat?" He says, "No, I have the cat." So, I mean, it's very on the nose that the Coens were going for this analysis of the movie that ties Lewin and the cat together.
Yeah, I think it's really on the nose only at the end of the movie, or towards the end of the movie, that you really realize.
Right, but this is my second watch. I mean, that little line right there gives it away once you're in the mind. I didn't notice it the first time, but after thinking about the fact that it's supposed to be a metaphor for, I guess, the spirit animal of Lewin.
Anthropomorphism?
Anthropomorphism is when...
I just knew it had anthropo in it.
But I'm talking about like a...
Yeah. I mean, in a way... Audrey Rouget serves the same purpose for Tom and Metropolitan.
I just rang the bell. Cease and desist.
You do know that.
Cease. I beg you.
All right.
But anyway, yes, at the end of the movie, we learn that the cat's name is Ulysses. And this works on several levels, too. One of them being that it's the title of James Joyce's maybe most famous novel, which I have not read, to my shame. But which I understand to be a look at one man's life in an episodic fashion that is not very plot heavy in and of itself, which is a lot like what we watch Lewin do in the movie. We get to see a lot of his life, but not a whole lot happens. On another level, since this is the Catholic Movie Guy podcast, I would be remiss if I didn't point out a connection I thought of when I saw the movie, which is the Ulysses of Dante's Inferno. And I believe this is an invention of Dante. It's not out of Greek mythology, to my knowledge. In Dante's Inferno, when he's in hell, he gives a speech, Ulysses, about why he ended up there. And he talks about, after he completed the Odyssey and all the events of that book, he went past Hercules' pillars, sailed for 5 months until he met his demise on the sea, through this kind of a wanderlust of, you know, what he felt, his desire to do.
And I think that him meeting his doom is very similar to what happens to Lewin in this movie.
Yeah, there was also pride in the case of Odysseus because, as is made clear, he sees an island afar off that was surrounded by nothing, just water, and the tallest mountain he'd ever seen. He actually glimpsed what Dante puts at the bottom of the world, which is the earthly paradise, the island of purgatory. So he had started to mess with the things of the gods, and that's what did him in. It was not just following his own way, but again, rebelling against the limits that God had set. God had put the pillars of Hercules there so people wouldn't sail beyond them, is the Dantean mindset.
Right, and what is in this movie, if we take this further, what is Lewin's pillars of Hercules? I would argue that it's the fact that he knows that he has at least one and potentially two children that he's going to be responsible for, and he shirks that responsibility to continue pursuing this folk music path.
Right, and within that world of folk music, I mean, it's obvious from watching the movie that he has skill, that he's good, and he certainly has every right to success that anybody else could claim there, except for Bob, and that success is somewhat arbitrary, but he wants to be a solo act, and it's clear that he's made for the duet or the trio, as Grossman tells him in Chicago, and he fails because he wants success on his own terms and not on the terms of having a partner.
Right. And, you know, in the movie, he's always just one step behind success. He records this pop, you know, this very jokey, hilarious pop music song with the Justin Timberlake character and Al Cody. Mm-hmm. And he is offered at the end to get clearance from his label so that he can get royalties. And we all know from, you know, the audience, I think it's clear to the audience that this song, because of its crappiness, is going to be a hit.
Right.
On some level.
That's America.
Right. And instead of getting permission from his label, waiting and getting the royalties and signing the real deal, appearing as a session musician, he so badly wants to pay for his paramour. His best friend's wife, one night stands, abortion.
Maybe not wife, girlfriend. Maybe.
Girl, I don't know, it's not clear, but yeah, his partner. He so badly needs to pay for her abortion that he signs away his life, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, and he just commits blunder after blunder in short-sighted pride.
And it occurred to me, too, just when we were talking about this partner deal, and he doesn't want to be in a duo or a trio, that his destiny depended upon his partner. They had some success. The partner kills himself. And that left Davis exposed, wounded, and messed up. So he never wanted to put himself in the power of another human being again. That's a direct parallel to him not wanting to have a child that he has to provide for, that has demands upon him. Maybe his happiness depends upon that child or the mother of that child.
Okay, so back to the child. So he's impregnated Jean, and he's going to facilitate her abortion. So he goes to meet with the abortion doctor, and as he's meeting with them, the abortion doctor tells him.
Yeah, I hate that phrase. It's a killer, an abortionist.
The abortionist.
Yes.
Tells him that 2 years ago, when he had paid for another female friend of his abortion, Diane, that she didn't go through with it, and she instead kept the baby and moved back to Akron, Ohio.
Yep.
So, during the course of this movie, he finds himself driving to and fro with Chicago, and on his way back, he sees a signpost for Akron. And you can tell by the look on his face that he's thinking about Diane, he's thinking about his child. He was clearly affected when the abortionist told him about it, too.
It was a very moving scene. I would say that he did a very good job of Akron there.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm violently ill with disgust.
I thought it was fantastic.
In any event, yeah, Oscar Isaac did a great job of conveying with that words the feelings he was going through. And he has plenty of opportunity to turn off at Akron, contemplates it for maybe like a fourth of a mile, half a mile, and passes the exit. The very next scene, it's snowing, it's dark, he's tired. A cat, the exact same looking cat as the Gorfines cat, goes in front of the car. He says, oh, he swerves to miss it, pulls off the side of the road, but it turns out he actually hit it. He goes outside of the car, examines the car, there's blood on the car. Then he looks toward the woods behind the car, and he sees a cat in dark shadows, which elderly amongst us, Tim, couldn't see, limping into the woods. And this reinforces the cat as Lewin metaphor. You know, it's almost too on the nose once you know it, but I like this kind of allegory.
I thought it was neat.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, he's clearly done violence to himself and is continuing to do violence to himself by not following the clear signposts, literal signposts, as to what he should do with his life.
And Akron's shown at night. I mean, you have the big city grid lit up. It's all this bright future.
Exactly. That's what struck me last night. And that is so, so intentional. And when these people talk about the Coens being nihilists and all this, I can't get on board. That is, if it weren't the Coens, if it were Mel Gibson's movie, you'd be like, wow, he is being really heavy-handed with the don't have an abortion, accept your fatherhood responsibilities bit. Akron is lit up like a Christmas tree. It looks like, you know, Akron, Vegas, New York. I mean, it is bright as all get out. And the entire movie, as you've noted, we noticed discussing the movie before the podcast, is so dark. Right. I mean, it's beautiful in its way, but it's very dark, almost a damp look to the movie. This is lit up.
Framing this as we've been jumping, or we've been dancing around it. I mean, I know you're setting this up, but it, as the Coen brothers, intentional or not, and obviously with everything you're saying, it's intentional. This is a pro-life movie because...
Right.
And I'm not saying... He's singing in the clubs, you know, hang me, oh, hang me, and all that kind of stuff. When he finally has his big trial with the folk music promoter Bud Grossman in Chicago, F. Murray Abraham,
what does he sing?
Sing me, you know, give me something inside Llewyn Davis. And he sings a song about about delivering a baby, about saving a baby at the cost of the mother's life even, but
right.
wanting to save an unborn child.
Yeah. I mean, it's clear as day. And I'm not taking credit for this. Would I have noticed it on my own? I don't know. But I read, I shared it with you, that article. There's a great review of the movie in First Things, and I cannot remember the author's name, but I'm sure if you Google First Things inside Llewyn Davis, you'll find it.
Yeah, it's not that you came up with it. I mean, we would have come across these themes with the idea
and,
that...
And I don't agree with everything in his article either, but he brings these themes out clearly.
That it's intentional by the Coens, because you figure the Coens, you know, with their hip movie-making ways... would probably be so-called pro-choice. But
and maybe they
this
are.
Is obviously know. Intentional. Whatever they did it, this is intentional.
Right, and I'm a big subscriber in the art is what it is. There's an objective meaning there. I don't know what they intended, but this movie is pro-life as the day is long. I can't see any way out of it. This man is tormented over this, at the very least. I mean, does it change what he does? No, it doesn't. But that's the tragedy of the movie. It's a tragedy, just like with Ulysses.
For local listeners, what he means is tormented. Hi, this is Tim.
Folks, there's nothing I can do about it. There's just nothing I can do. You know, you accept the good and the bad with Tim. It's been happening my whole life. And that's fine. You know, we love him. And we love him because of those puns. We love him because of the wordplay. However bad it may be.
Yeah.
Yeah. You are who again?
I'm the Tin Man.
Right, the Tin Man. So, by the end of the movie, having gone through all of this, what do we learn about Llewyn's future?
Two things, and it depends on whether you're a glass half full or a glass half empty. He's determined to make these mistakes. They're going to repeat themselves. He gets beaten up at the beginning of the movie, gets beaten up at the end, and he... waves a wistful au revoir to the cab that drives away with the beater upper in it.
Right. So,
but there are certain things that make you think that he's able to change it and turn it around.
I see. I don't think so. I got nothing like that. Although, you know, let's jump to the end. So the movie begins with the ending of the movie, him playing in a club. And it just so happens that he's opening, he doesn't even know it, for Bob Dylan.
It ends with the beginning.
No, it doesn't. It's clear from a second watch. Because the Gorfines cat, the progress of where he is and all that, it's clear that the Gorfines, at the end, they say, we got our cat back. So it's clear that all that stuff happened before the last scene. In any event, the night before the last scene, he heckles some poor woman who's terrible, to be fair. And he heckles her in a very degrading manner.
He wasn't nice.
He was not nice, and he gets thrown out of the club. Then the next day, he goes back, and it turns out he's opening for Bob Dylan. He has no idea who Bob Dylan is or what that's all about. But as Dylan starts to play, all you see is the silhouette of Dylan. You hear his music. He gets called outside by the woman's husband, and he proceeds to beat him up. But he gets called outside because of his heckling the night before, which was all pride. You know, she's not a pure folk singer. She's not as good as me, blah, 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 blah. And because of that, he misses Bob Dylan. He misses the next thing that's coming. He's always a step behind because of his own pride.
By the way, Bob Dylan is fantastic. And when we come to rate the movie, as I tell you, I have an absolute rule that any movie that has Bob Dylan's music as the ending song, trailer, credits, whatever, it goes up a full point just for that fact.
Okay. And we'll get to the rating in just a minute. We're going to wrap it up pretty soon here. But I think, you know, he says at one point, for one of his songs, it's a folk song, which means it's never been old and it's never new. And that's kind of his life too, but it also is what separates him and just singing an old folk song from Dylan, which is he took something old and made it completely new and his own. Yeah. And the gap between what Dylan did and what Oscar right. Isaac, Llewyn Davis, or any other person
Dave Van Ronk on who he is
right. Based. Is enormous. Even though when you listen to Oscar Isaac sing these songs as Llewyn Davis, they're beautiful yeah. and touching and beautiful in a way that Dylan is not. Mm. But, you know, you don't have to convince me. Obviously, we agree 100% on this, that Dylan is resonant in a completely deeper way.
Right. It's just what Dylan did was he, like he does with every genre of music he touches, he perfected folk and then killed it because he wrote his own stuff and played it. He wasn't necessarily relying upon the old standards, which, of course, he did and still does.
Well, he started out doing the old standards, and then right. he made them his own, and right. then he made his own standards.
Yeah, and then he moved way beyond it.
But let's dial it one step back. One scene that was really touching and testifies to the power of music is when he goes and plays for his dad in the old folks home, or the
convalescent. Yeah, his dad's real gone.
His dad is totally gone. He has a blank look. He starts talking to him, and nothing's getting through. Then he starts into this old folk song, which he knew his dad liked from when he was a kid. And his dad, he gets a knowing look on his face. He looks out the window. There's a look of
where there's light?
Yeah. There's a speaking beyond human words.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I feel the same way about a great film, but a great
song. It's beautiful, and the cinematography is beautiful. You're totally in the mood. You feel like you're in Greenwich Village. As Bob would say on one of his wonderful songs, back at that time period, you absolutely put yourself in that place. Yeah. And again, this isn't original to me. I forget it was whether it was in the Atlantic review of this movie on the Coen Brothers review, but if you take Bob Dylan on Free Will and Bob Dylan, he's walking down the street in love with Susie Rotolo. Okay.
Rotolo,
whatever.
Rotolo?
I don't know. And you excise them from that photo, and what you have is a grimy, cruddy New York City street scene with snow and dirt and grime. And you get everything without the love scene in here.
Yeah, but that's also the artifice and also the, you know, memory. It's always like that in your memory, but when you go back, yeah, you don't remember the slush on the street and maybe the street sweeper going by and
yeah.
all that stuff. Yeah, this movie presents both sides of that, but I think it's very fair to that scene while also not glorifying it in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the very end, you know, we're left. The first time I watched it, I was like, okay, that's it? What happened? You know, so what do you think happened to Llewyn Davis after the credits roll?
Well, I guess I think that he is capable of making marginal changes.
Did he ship off with the Navy or whatever?
No, he couldn't even quit the folk scene. I think he's destined to run that loop for a while, but it doesn't have to end in tragedy, is I think what you're left with there.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the Coen, so they're not gonna leave you with the happy ending generally.
I wasn't actually left with this feeling of what was that. I was left with this feeling that I knew that I had seen great something great. Art.
Yeah,
this was great.
But why is it good?
And I had to think about it for about a week to figure it all out.
Yeah, and I agree with that, but
I mean, just everything just rings true, and all these people that are involved in the folk scene, are they friends? Yeah, they're friends. They're rivals. They're like members of the secret club. They have new people going in and out. It is it's like Sally Fowler's Rat Pack in Metropolitan. When
ladies and gentlemen, I suppose that's it for today. Tim's decided to end the podcast early.
What, are you kidding me?
You're right. It's not that early. But, I mean, really, this is pathetic now at this point.
No, I mean, these people got together over Christmas.
The bell has rung.
Unbelievable. You know,
Tim,
art is art, buddy.
Yes, art is art indeed. I mean, who could argue against that, really?
Ain't nobody.
Tim, I'm a just judge, not like our Lord. But I will let you rate the movie out of 10 as is custom.
I give this a flat out 9.9.
Please.
The Tin Man, 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 the Tin Man.
That's it. It's over. Catholic Movie Geek Podcast. What a week we've been through, ladies and gentlemen. This is the cherry on the proverbial cake.
Yeah.
Next week we'll be back. At least I'll be back. I don't know if it's going to be Tim. I don't know if it'll be the Brewmaster General.
He's, might have my appendix out.
I recently saw the new movie, the Amy Adams film Arrival, which I want to indeed, which I want to review, but I don't know if it's worthy of a whole podcast. We're also going to go over Tim's perhaps favorite movie ever, not the best movie ever, The Way. I don't know whether I'm going to jam those into the same podcast next week or separate them. But nevertheless, we'll be back in some form or fashion in the next week. And I'm the Catholic Movie Guy, and I'm out.
Oh, yeah, wait.
If you like the music, it's called Waste Technology by Jazar. BetterWithMusic.com. Check him out. Until next time, I am the Catholic Movie Guy.